This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, the fallout continues over Senator Elizabeth Warren's DNA test. Warren released a video Monday saying the test proves that she has Native American ancestry and disproves President Trump's criticism of her family lore.
Now, the president likes to call my mom a liar. What do the facts say?
The facts suggest that you
absolutely have a Native American ancestor in your pedigree.
But the test has provoked some strong criticism from both Republicans and Democrats, even from the tribe that Warren says is part of her heritage. The Cherokee Nation Secretary of State called Warren's DNA test inappropriate and wrong, and President Trump is now calling on Warren to apologize.
What about the money that I owe her?
She owes the country an apology.
Warren did express regret for not clearly making the distinction that only Native American tribes and not DNA tests determine tribal citizenship. And this is the first issue that we're going to take up with our Week in Review panelists this week. Charlie Chippio is a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Hello, and thanks for coming in.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Hi there, Arlene.
Hi, Deborah.
So, obviously, strong backlash over this DNA test, probably not what Senator Warren expected. Arlene, was this a miscalculation by her campaign?
Well, you know, the truth is, I think this whole issue of people attacking her about her heritage is really appalling. It's an ad hominem attack. When you can't attack someone and win on the issues themselves, you go after the person. It's honestly a distraction from the main event. And the main event is, if you disagree with her policies, that's fine, that's fair, I can respect that. But to focus so much on whether or not the particular nature of her DNA makeup is, I find offensive at best.
But why take the bait?
Well, she has no choice because Trump's been putting it out there. And in the Trump era, distraction is the rule of the game. You know, I mean, the reality is that we all have family lore about who we are and where we came from. And we're all raised with stories that may or may not be true. But if you ever saw that television commercial for Ancestry.com where a guy stands there in lederhosen and says, I was raised to think we were German and now I found out we're Scottish, and he changes to a kilt. You know, you can't be blamed for what your family told you. And you have every reason and right to respect it and believe it.
Okay. Charlie Chippio, what do you think of this? Do you think that that she did this because she had to dispute what the president was saying?
Well, I think she felt like she had to. I guess I agree with Arlene. I just think it's such a sad commentary on where we've come. You know, I mean, I could see this whole thing, you know, being a one-day story after she claimed it a long time ago. But to, you know, hear that we are, what, a couple of years after this all started, that we're, you know, we're doing this. This is kind of like the birther thing. I mean, it's just...
Well, exactly,
you know,
which is what a lot of analysts are saying. She had to, because it is like the dispute over President Obama's birth certificate. But so has this made it worse for Elizabeth Warren?
Has it made it worse? I mean, in what context? I mean, I you know, I don't think she's staying awake at night worrying about the Senate race coming up. I mean,
so is she worried about another race?
Oh, I think, I think perhaps. You know, I think her chances of ultimately winning that race are about equal with her chances of losing this one.
Mm-hmm.
But sure, maybe she is. I mean, I would think that's what she's thinking about. Yeah.
And let's talk about the tone. I know both of you say that you're dismayed by the tone of all of this and the fact that we're at this point where we're testing and what and who's calling who names and all of this. But I just want to point out that, let's say, the president had said in July that if she proved her ancestry, he would donate $1 million to charity. This week he said no, he never said that. And then later he walked back and said he would donate the money, but he had a condition. Let's listen.
I'll only do it if I can test her personally. Okay, that will not be something I enjoy doing either.
So that was from the president, and this likely will continue to be an issue because we've heard Republicans are continuing to say that this isn't completely truthful about her ancestry. And, of course, there was all kinds of confusion and misreporting about what these tests meant, the genetics, the math. So I guess it's not going to go away. What's the best way to go forward?
Well, you know, one thing before answering that question is Trump's response to that I find a little bit misogynistic. All right, I'm being gentle. And you know, but I'm not sure everyone has picked up on that.
Right.
It's kind of like that joke, that horrible statement he made about the commentator who was bleeding or something.
Oh, Megyn Kelly.
Let's not say it again.
That's right. So that's threaded in a lot of his comments about this. And I think she had no choice. She had to deal with it. And it would be there whether she dealt with it or not, because he's not going to give up on his Pocahontas taunting. So she might as well just get the story out.
But did she have to do this to make a presidential run?
Yes, unfortunately, really? I think she has to, because like with Obama's birth certificate, you just have to answer it. Otherwise, it goes on and on and on. Now, truthfully, I think it'll go on and on and on
anyway,
no matter what.
Yeah.
But the notion that that Trump would back off the bet, I'm not shocked on the one hand, but people should be calling him on it. You made a bet, you'll give $100 million to charity, do it.
Well, no, you're absolutely right about that, but... Again, I think what makes all this so complicated is because it's such a new world. I mean, this guy does things at least on a weekly basis, any one of which would have ended any other person's political career.
Yeah.
So this is such uncharted territory that I don't think we really know how to react to a lot of what he does.
Okay. Well, just quickly, Arlene, Charlie gave us his thoughts about Elizabeth Warren's chances in 2020. Do you think it's a good idea for her to pursue the presidency?
You know, I'm really not sure. She certainly is qualified in the extreme for the position. The question is how misogynistic the voter base is.
Really?
I think so. I think that played, just like racism played a part of Obama's campaign, though he was able to prevail against it. Misogyny certainly played a role in Hillary Clinton's. Not that some people, of course, voted against her no matter what, but there was a misogynistic component to it.
So a woman couldn't win?
No, I think a woman can. But I think the reality is that there's a misogynistic thread running through some of the voter base that we have to deal with. We have to learn how to deal with.
I think there are certain... there are certain personality traits that a man could have and win, but a woman could not win with those traits.
Right. Yeah. And so does she have too many of those traits to win?
I think she probably does, and I don't mean that as a criticism against her. I'm just saying that as just an observation of what the political reality is out there.
Right. Well, let's move on to the governor's race here in Massachusetts. There was a debate this week between the two main candidates, Charlie Baker, Democrat Jay Gonzalez. And there's a big moment in this debate when Democratic gubernatorial candidate Jay Gonzalez asked Governor Baker about his promise to support the entire Republican ticket. So that, of course, includes Jeff Deal, who's a pro-Trump Republican running for Senate. Let's listen to this.
You going to vote for Jeff Deal?
Governor?
I'm going to vote for me, and I'm going to vote for Karen Pulido, and I'm going to vote for a series of other candidates as well. I don't know what I'm going to do yet with respect to that one.
You don't know if you're going to vote for the guy you endorsed?
I haven't made a decision.
Okay, it's a very uncomfortable moment there for Charlie Baker.
Cringeworthy.
Oh, yeah. Everyone was going, But, you know, his indecision didn't last very long. Right after the debate, this is what the governor said. He made up his mind.
I simply misspoke, but I'm going to vote for the ticket. And I think it's interesting that my opponent spends so much time talking about the U.S. Senate race and so little time talking about the race for governor.
Okay, Charlie Chippio, that gaffe, how big of a deal was that for Charlie Baker?
Well, I think it is important for Jay Gonzalez. I actually give Gonzalez credit because if you watched it, you know that they were sort of ending that session, the moderators, and he sort of stopped and directly asked the governor, which I thought was very very good move on his part. I think it provides some attention to Jay Gonzalez, which perhaps he could use to sort of get some other ideas out there. I think in and of itself. I think, for the most part, the only people who are really going to be affected or really riled up about that moment are probably the people who were likely to vote for Jay Gonzalez anyway. So I'm not sure that in and of itself is a big deal, but it certainly certainly gives him an opening.
I wonder what your take is, Arlene.
Well, as my teenagers used to say, awkward. So
it might still do.
I don't actually think he misspoke. I think he was, there was a deer in the headlights moment there. And I suppose to his credit, he didn't want to lie. But I think he was genuinely torn. And it was smart of Gonzalez to go after him for that. Those of us who are in politics understand the nature of the beast is that you usually do have to, for a variety of reasons, political reasons, have to support the people in your party.
But let's talk about a little bit deeper, right? Because here's Charlie Baker, moderate Republican in Massachusetts, possibly, as all the polls, however these polls are determined, say most popular governor in the country, highest approval ratings, okay? That's how he is described. But has he really been a moderate Republican who has been able to encourage bipartisanship? And what does this say about sort of distancing himself from somebody who is a pro-Trump person?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a lot of currents going on here. I think this is a very interesting dynamic. You know, in Massachusetts, obviously, you know, we are to the left of the rest of the country, and I think that most folks think of the Republican Party here as being to the left of the National Republican Party. And I think in many ways it is. But what we saw in the primary was that the core of the Republican Party, who really comes out and votes in primaries and things like that, are very conservative. You know, I mean, look, you know, I don't mean to be blunt, although I usually am. You know, I mean, a crazy person got 36% against him in the primary.
That's pretty blunt.
Yeah. So, I mean, so he's in a very difficult position. He needs the Republicans who voted in the primary.
Does he? I mean, that's my question.
He needs them to show up. I think he does need them to show up. Hmm. I think he does need. And look, one thing we know to actually answer your question, you know, I think he has been very bipartisan. I give him credit for that. But I also think one thing we've seen about him is he's very cautious and he does not take anything for granted, and he has not up until now spent a lot of his political capital, and so I think that he's trying to, you know, walk a very fine line. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Charlie Baker has to take a stand really in any regard, Arlene, to win this election?
I mean, I wish he did speak out against the Jeff Deals of the world, but again, I consider it somewhat politically unrealistic just because of the nature of the political party system that we have here. I do give him credit for saying a year ago that he didn't vote for Trump, but as to what was just saying, he is going to get any Republican who's a Trump voter who comes out to vote in November is going to vote for Charlie Baker. There's no question about that. Or the Scott Lively supporters. They'll hold their nose about, you know, they may not agree with him on choice, but they'll vote for him anyway. And he needs to focus on the middle, the independents, and the moderates. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's done.
I think that's generally true. But I do think that he is concerned, whether he needs to be or not, we'll see. But I think he is concerned that a lot of those folks won't show up. I think they won't show up unless they have a reason to.
Yeah. And so this gives them a reason. Yeah. Okay. Well, what might make people show up at the polls are these ballot questions, right? I mean, we've certainly got some very interesting, controversial ballot questions. Here on Radio Boston, we hosted two debates on the questions this week. The first was on question 3, which asks whether voters approve of the state law that bans discrimination based on gender identity in public accommodations. Now, a yes vote would keep the current law, a no vote repeals it. And on the show, we had Casey Saffredini, who's with Freedom for All Massachusetts, and he said a yes vote protects people's rights.
You know, we're all human beings. We're all neighbors. We're family members. We're friends. We're coworkers. And at the end of the day, we don't have to understand everything about each other to be able to treat each other decently and with dignity and respect.
And then we also spoke with Andrew Beckwith, president of the Massachusetts Family Institute, urging a no vote. He said this has nothing to do with transgender rights. It's about public safety.
Our concerns really have nothing to do with individuals who identify as transgender. It's the abuse, the potential abuse of this law by people who are predators.
Now, the campaign for question 3 has used some very very controversial ads regarding this question. And I want to play part of a digital video ad that's urging a no vote on question three. And in this ad, a man enters a woman's locker room and hides. When a woman comes in, as the woman starts to get undressed, she realizes the man is in there. Let's listen to part of the ad.
What does Massachusetts question three mean to you? It means any man who says he is a woman can enter a woman's locker room, dressing room, or bathroom at any time, even convicted sex offenders. And if you see something suspicious and say something to authorities, you could be the one arrested and fined up to $50,000.
Yikes. So, Arlene, just wondering, what do you think of the ad and the debate on this question, which I think is public safety and human rights?
Well, I have a arguably unique perspective on this. I've been working on this issue for 10, 12 years, so I feel very passionately about voting yes to, and I think most fair-minded people will vote yes to protect trans folks. But the premise is simple, that their trans neighbor should be treated equally under the law with the same respect and dignity that anyone else in our community would deserve and want. You know, but it parallels what happened with the gay and lesbian community. In 1989, we passed the exact same bill that you can't discriminate in, based on sexual orientation and employment, housing, credit, and public accommodations. 20 years now, our opponents used the bathroom argument against us back then. 20 years later, the Trans Equal Protection Bill passes, and the exact same argument comes up, except this time it's about you can't discriminate based on gender identity in employment, housing, credit, public accommodations. What did the legislature do? They bifurcated the bill. They passed just the employment piece and the education piece and the housing piece, and they said we'll wait on public accommodations. And a few years later, a year or so ago, they passed the bill saying you can't discriminate. 2 years ago in 2016. That you can't discriminate against trans people based on gender identity in public accommodations, which means hospitals and grocery stores and on public buses and in a theater. So the argument about safety is bogus, because the people who are screaming about safety now, they actually opposed it, opposed these protections when it had to do with employment, denying people jobs, and they use the same argument against us, the gay and lesbian community.
So why not go after the safety argument then, instead of just focusing on the human rights argument? Would that be a better way to do it?
Well, we actually did, and the campaign is doing that still. We made a point when lobbying the bill to show that the police supported the legislation, that women's groups supported the legislation, and that entities like Jane Doe that dedicate themselves to protecting women also supported the bill. And now they support us. They want to vote yes on question three as well. So we have the facts, but our opponents are using fear-mongering.
Mm-hmm. Charlie Shipfield, your thoughts on this campaign in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other side, obviously, on this, you know, it's their right to bring it to the ballot and go through this. But, you know, in a perfect world, this has no place on the ballot. You know, this has been debated thoroughly, and it has, and the legislature has acted on it, and the bill was signed into law. You know, since that happened, I haven't seen any sort of horrible things that have happened. And I guess to bring it to a very personal level, I spend a lot of time worrying about my 15-year-old daughter, but this does not make me worry. You know, I just don't really see an issue here.
Okay, well, I now have to end with our hubbubs here. And these are the brief stories or events that have caught our attention this week. That's all we have time for, unfortunately. So let's do these hubbubs. Arlene, your hubbub.
Oh, well, my hubbub is about Halloween, that it's not just for kids anymore. The Beacon Hill Times recently listed, reminded people of the street closures that will take place on Halloween so that trick-or-treaters can walk in the street without cars and traffic. Mm. And in fact, many neighborhoods are now finding that the adults are getting into Halloween, whether they have kids or not, whether they just hang out on their porches and their decks and their city stoops and as they give out handy and dress in costumes. And Halloween has become a great opportunity to get to meet and to know your neighbors. You know, sometimes people know each other because they share kids in common, or they know each other because they all have dogs and they go to the dog park together. But even with the people that you may disagree with politically, you can enjoy and appreciate each other as neighbors, at least for a few hours, on Halloween. We can all benefit
because you're wearing a mask.
Exactly.
Because you're being nice to everyone, and you're enjoying each other, and you're enjoying the holiday. It's, you know, we all benefit because it creates a common ground with neighbors. And so I actually believe Halloween can help make the world a better place, even if it's just for one day a year.
All right. All right. Very nice hubbub. Charlie, what's your hubbub?
I thought you were going to different. I thought you were getting to something about how it's a night for the parents to get together and somehow avoid the kids. Or,
well, that happens too.
Well, for those of you who've been wondering what goes on at U.S. embassies around the world, here's a report from our embassy in Australia. There, an unknown number of people mistakenly received an email invite to a cat pajama party last week. The invitation featured a cat lying back on a couch in an electric blue Cookie Monster costume with a plate of cookies on its fuzzy belly. Turns out it was a training error made by a new staff member testing out the embassy's email newsletter platform, and the embassy will be introducing, quote, strong new management controls to ensure that there is no repeat of this high-level diplomatic gaffe. But it appears that the party has taken on a life of its own. New Zealand's embassy is among those.
Scott Brown, we should
no,
say.
No, but I think it's actually the New Zealand's embassy to Australia, not Scott
Brown. Okay.
I was hoping there was going to be a local angle to
no
this.
No local
but I don't
angle
think
here.
It is.
Okay, so we should say Scott Brown is. Okay,
but New Zealand's embassy is among those who will attend a virtual online celebration of the pajama cat party. So.
All right, very nice. Well, for my hubbub, I'm going to start with a question to both of you. Did you buy a Mega Millions ticket? $1 billion jackpot, I just want to point out. And I'm told that tickets today are selling at a rate of $3,000 a minute.
Oh, my
right
gosh.
Now. So I'm wondering, so you guys, did you miss this? Did you,
Mega
Millions ticket?
I keep losing with lottery tickets, but the biggest problem is that I forget to buy them.
Yeah.
Yeah, right, you definitely lose that way.
I have a strange perspective on this. I want like a $2 million lottery win so that I'm sort of below the radar. I don't have all these hassles that come along with the world going after you and try to scam you.
$1 billion
kind of scares me a little bit.
Yeah, like the New Hampshire winner
who sued first and
asked for anonymity before she would accept the jackpot. Well, for this, I actually have a guest for my hubbub, and I'm allowed to do this, right? So I have
this show.
Is a math expert, right, to help us understand the odds here because we're talking about 3,000 tickets a minute being sold, which we found incredible. So we asked George Reck, the director of the Math Resource Center at Babson, to come on the show in just for about a minute or so. Hello, Professor. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi. Thank you very much.
So these Mega Millions odds here are 1 in 300 million or so. That doesn't sound very good. Just briefly, tell us, what does the math behind those numbers suggest?
Well, it basically, the math is a series of all the different combinations of the way you could draw the numbers. And so, you know, there are probably syndicates out there trying to put together groups and groups of people to try and capture every number on the hope of winning.
Mm-hmm.
But think about how long it would take to do that.
Right, right. Sounds like an awful, awful lot of work and a lot of money. And they also actually changed the odds not that long ago to make it even harder for people to win, so the jackpots would get bigger. So from a math perspective, I'm wondering, with those kinds of odds, what's your advice here?
Well, the advice is simple. You're not likely to win.
Right. Well, we knew that.
But the risk is very low. I mean, one of the things we teach here is risk and reward. When you're only risking $2 for a ticket, you're not putting yourself out that much. You know, it's a cup of coffee. It's a candy bar at the vending machine, which actually I just got a few minutes ago. It was almost $2 for a candy bar. Skip your candy bar, buy a lottery ticket.
Yeah, but still, it's like throwing it away. At least you get to eat the candy, right?
That's true, but there's entertainment value. Plus, I heard earlier you were talking about things that might unify people. This is probably one of the number one social topics out there, and everybody seems to have a positive attitude about it, talking about what they would do if they had the money to, if they won the money.
What would you do?
Take my wife on a long-awaited honeymoon somewhere. First class all the way.
Oh, nice. Very nice. Arlene, what would you do? Don't know?
No, I agree with what was said a short while ago. The I'd be happy to win a mere $2 million.
A mere $2
million.
Exactly. But Charlie, what if you did win?
I have endless wanderlust, so travel would be
travel.
The
there
first,
you go. See?
My first priority.
All right. Well, I think that George Reck was right. It brought all of us together. Well, good luck. Good luck, and thank you, George Reck, director of the Math Resource Center at Babson College. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome.
Also, Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the plans for a space force to be part of the U.S. military and what that might mean for Massachusetts. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.